Rerum Navarum. Deuteronomy Milud was relatively brief. Rerum Navarum is big. Thanks. Has everybody got a copy of the plan? We're going to take easily most of three instructions just to cover the ground. This schema that you have in front of you is in two parts. Part one, socialism refuted, and then if you turn over the page, it is part two, Catholicism to the rescue. In brief, the first part is a refutation of socialism. Socialism is the wrong answer to the problems of today, the problems of the late 19th century. It's a wrong answer to the capital-labor problem. And then what is the right answer? The right answer is Catholicism. Pope Leo shocked a number of people. They thought he was a communist, they thought he was a red, because of especially 46 to 67, what he teaches about the state. He teaches the state can and must sometimes intervene to look after the working class. And people say, socialism. No, he's just refuted socialism. It's neither socialism nor free-for-all capitalism. Or free-for-all capitalism. Free-for-all capitalism means the triumph of the sharks. Free play for the sharks. No, the government has got to stop the sharks. Look at Enron. Look at Enron and WorldCom and all of these. These sharks that are fleecing. They're paying themselves vast salaries. And then they're all selling their stock. They're taking tremendous amounts of stock and selling it at the top of the market, and the little guy is taking it on the chin. No, the government has to protect the little guy against the sharks. So it's the Catholic answer. The Catholic answer is neither one extreme nor the other. The Catholic answer is the right balance. So in some ways, Rerum Novarum is a little out of... Well, is it? I was going to say it's out of date. It's out of date in the sense that the particularly sharp clash between capital and labor that there was at the end of the 19th century is no longer there, because in general, the workers, the working class, especially in the United States, was given in the early years of the 20th century, even in the late years of the 19th century in the United States. In the United States, the clash was never so sharp because everybody has been well off. Even the poor have not been that poor. And most of the workers have had not a bad life here in the United States. For various reasons, not thanks to free-for-all capitalism, but to a good dose of American common sense and capitalism. The capitalism here has not been as sharp, perhaps, as over in Europe, or has not been as hard on the workers, but you see it, you see the same old thing coming out with Enron. So, and the principles, so in some ways it's out of date, but in a lot of ways it's not out of date. The economic problem is always ready to come back if the religious problem and the political problem are unsolved. If the religious problem is unsolved, and of course it's more and more unsolved today, then the politics are bound to go crazy. If the politics go crazy, you can't solve the economics. Let's have a look at what Leo XIII says. Firstly, socialism refuted. From 1 down to 85. But actually, from 1 to 23, then 24 to 81, you turn over the page, and then you come back for 82 to 85, if you see what's going on. So, you've got, firstly, the problem. This schema is a little bit complicated. I warn you in advance. It could be simplified, but it's molded absolutely on the text. So if you're reading the text, this should help you to see which way the text is going, where it's going, and how it all fits together. But it could be simplified still further, so we may simplify some. The problem, 1 to 6. 7 to 23, the false solution. 24 to 81, the true solution. Once again, he lays out the error and then lays out the truth. And that's the natural way to do it. And then a conclusion, 82 to 85. The problem is capital against labor, horrible work conditions for the workers all ready to get up in revolt and overthrow, fight, murder, overthrow, kill capital. The problem was quite sharp. In the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, in Europe, industry, and in the United States, industry was really getting going. The Industrial Revolution was really underway. It's a new kind of life. It's a new framework of life. There's a lot of adjusting going on. There's a lot of human greed, especially on the part of the capitalists. They're exploiting the workers. The workers are boiling with rage. There's going to be an explosion. What should we do? Novel social conditions, one. Upon the modern revolutions in politics was bound to follow today's conflict in economics. So there you are, the Pope has it clear. Economics follow on politics. That's a crucial truth for a Catholic to remember. To try to solve economical problems by merely economical means is very short-sighted. And to try to solve political problems by economic means is even more short-sighted. So, the revolutions in politics, 1789, 1830, 1848, 1870, four major revolutions in France and in other countries as well. These revolutions, and then the Industrial Revolution, especially the Industrial Revolution, has completely changed working conditions for a huge number of workers. They're no longer farmers on the land. They're off the land. They're in the factories. The situation is very different. And somebody's got to do some thinking to disentangle it. Here's the church thinking. The gravity of this problem, for all men and for all the Pope, today's conflict in economics, which is currently preoccupying everybody concerned. Anybody who's got a hell on his shoulders in 1880, 1890 is worried about this potential explosion of the workers. It's tearing society, ready to tear society apart. Three, to the question of the workers' condition, we shall then devote this whole encyclical, the condition of the workers, the working men's conditions. Notice the title of the encyclical, Rerum Novarum, of literally of new things. And the Pope is undoubtedly saying that the, let's see what exactly how he puts it, of new things, on the condition of the working classes, it's a long one, starting page 110, there we are. Once the passion for revolutionary change was aroused, a passion long disturbing governments, it was bound to follow sooner or later that eagerness for change would pass from the political sphere over into the related field of economics. Once the passion for revolutionary change, I think that's rerum novarum. I'd have to look at the Latin, but the English for rerum novarum, it looks as though he's translated by revolutionary change. In fact, new developments in industry, new techniques striking out on new paths, changed relations of employer-employee, abounding wealth among a very small number and destitution among the masses, increased self-reliance on the part of workers as well as a closer bond of union with one another. And in addition to all this, a decline in morals have caused conflict to break forth. We've got a very new social situation in the 1880s, 1890s. Society is changing. It's changing fast. And the framework of society, the very framework is changing. How are we going to handle it? 4, 5, 6, the difficulty. Relations between capital and labor are a vexed question, being moreover distorted by villains. There are bad guys, who aren't Nazis. There are bad guys who are at work exploiting this situation and making a million. Clearly the poor in their present undeserved wretchedness must be relieved. That's not socialism to say so. It's not socialism, it's common sense. If you create an overprivileged minority and an oppressed majority, of course there's going to be disaster. It's common sense. Guildless, religionless, the workers are being virtually enslaved by a few inhuman, greedy usurers. No marks for guessing who that principally is. But one may not name them. Look at what he says, page 112. A devouring usury, halfway down paragraph 6, page 112. A devouring usury, the church has always condemned usury, making money just with money. Although often condemned by the church, but practiced nevertheless under another form by avaricious and grasping men, has increased the evil, and in addition, the whole process of production, as well as trade in every kind of goods, has been brought almost entirely under the power of a few. You look at the American economy over the last 20, 30 years, and you'll have to agree, even more is being brought under the power of even fewer. That's the tendency all the time. So that a few very rich and exceedingly rich men have laid a yoke almost of slavery on the unnumbered masses of non-owning workers. Today, I think they'd call it punch clock slavery. That's to say, people aren't slaves, and they're proud of not being slaves, but people are virtually enslaved to their mortgage, to their punch clock, to their commuting. It's a slave's existence in a way, especially that mortgage. They've got the system so that everybody has to pay three times the value of the house they live in. It's cleverly done. Cleverly done. But you're absolutely free to buy the house or not. You're free. I haven't taken away your freedom, but I've enslaved you. We've got an apparent freedom and a real slavery today. This isn't out of date. Certainly not out of date is a few clever money men pulling to themselves more and more power and virtually enslaving the masses, even those who consider themselves to be free. But today, the enslavement of the middle class by mortgages is not quite the same thing as the enslavement of the workers by working conditions in the factories. It's not quite the same. But it's the same men behind it. It's the same usurers, the same money men behind it.
Health insurance wasn't the same area.
Sorry?
Health insurance. There's have to be a slave to that job because they couldn't afford, they got family, they couldn't afford the insurance for health for their families.
Yeah. It's slavery that's come back again through the back door, in effect. The false solution, socialism. Now, as you can see, all these brackets, it gets a bit complicated, but I think we can disentangle it. 7 to 23. Notice then, the Pope is not a socialist. He may seem so when he says that the state must intervene, but he is not a socialist. Okay. The essence of socialism, 7, is the abolition of property. So, the socialists propose to abolish private property and to divide all wealth equally amongst everyone. And socialism is hugely advanced. I mean, the government of the United States is virtually socialist. The Republicans think like socialists, let alone the Democrats. Let the government strip the rich and give out to all of the supposed poor. It's a socialistic system. F.D. Roosevelt obviously promoted vastly. Have pushed forward socialism in the United States with his quote-unquote New Deal. The socialists propose to abolish private property. So you see, if you've got, there's a solution. If you've got a mass of wealth in the hands of a few and nothing in the hands of many, well then grab from the few and distribute by government force amongst the many. That's socialism. Refuted. After he's laid out the socialism, he now refutes it from 8 through to 23. And you've got a thesis, 8, and then proofs, 9 to 22, and then a conclusion, 23. The thesis is, paragraph 8, what the Catholic proposition is, that the abolition of private property and dividing it all equally amongst everybody is unjust. It's unjust. It's not just. It looks just to share everything out absolutely equally by force. No, it's not just. It harms both the workers and the owners. It doesn't only harm the owners from whom you take the property away. It also harms the workers. And it harms states and it harms governments. So it's a bad deal. To solve the problem by abolishing property which was the solution that the French thinkers were coming up with in the 1820s. Proudhon, I think, is one of the most earliest and the most famous. Proudhon. Abolish property. Then, of course, a key plank of the communist platform is always abolish property. All property in the hands of the state. No, says the Pope, the abolition of property is unjust. It harms workers and owners. Or it harms owners and workers. So it's not, to abolish property is not for the benefit of the people. It will harm the people. And it harms the states and it harms governments. It harms the state because you create, what's happened in the United States, you've got what we call in England welfare bums. I'm sure, is that what you've got? I mean, it's miserable. Characters who are experts in one thing, and that is how to soak the government. All the details of the checks and what day to collect and how to collect, and they're experts. And and then the rest of their life, they live a life of Riley on welfare checks. It's unspeakable. It's not for their good. It's the ruination of their families. I'm talking about a certain kind of human being here in the United States who is distinguishable by his, by his ability to play basketball. There we are. nine. Okay, now we get into the proofs. How do you prove that the abolition of property is wrong? And the Pope has got a proof for the person, for the family, and for society. Once again, the three layers. Individual, family, so individual, familial, social. All three layers, the abolition of property is a bad thing. Okay, firstly for the individual person, 9 to 17. Again, he subdivides. It subdivides into an argument for arguments of reason, argument of authority. 17, the argument of authority is quite easy. Natural law, age-old custom, are confirmed by civil law and divine law. That's a stack of arguments for private property. The need of private property is obvious. It should be obvious. But in our modern age, no. In our poor modern age, our modern age is so crazy that even private property seems doubtful. But it is common sense. And Americans have not lost that common sense. Americans believe in private property, obviously. Americans, and they're quite right. So, the Pope believes in private property. So, arguments of authority, 17. Noticeably, the 7th and 10th commandments. You can't get a more blockbusting argument than that. Thou shalt not steal, 7th commandment, says, if something is somebody else's property, it's not going to be yours, and you mustn't take it. And you mustn't even desire it. 10th commandment. Socialism is the massive, organized violation of the 7th and 10th commandments. No wonder socialism is wrong. That's the blockbusting argument. The Pope doesn't make too much of it here, but that's about the grandest argument you can have. But there's divine law, civil law. Any government naturally protects property. It has to. Otherwise you've got chaos. Age-old custom. Wherever you've got a community in old times, ever since the beginning of time you've got property. It's only our own modern mad age that dreams of abolishing property. Age-old custom and natural law. Natural law is that people own things, that things are owned by people, and when they're owned by X, they shouldn't be taken by Y. It's natural law. So there are the arguments of authority. But the Pope advances arguments of reason. The argument of authority means the king says, or God says, or the law says, or the government says. That's an argument of authority. An argument of reason is why, in the very nature of things, it's right that. One thing is right and the opposite is wrong. In the very nature of things. For instance, in the very nature of man and wife, adultery is wrong and artificial means of birth control are wrong. It's the very nature of man and wife. So, besides being condemned, of course, in that case, by the 6th and the 9th commandments and so on and so on. So the argument of reason is the arguments why the abolition of property is wrong. Arguments of reason. He's got three: the future, the present, and the past. Again, it's a perfectly logical division. The most complicated is the present, will come to it. The future, as to the future, an argument of reason why the abolition of property is wrong. Abolishing property, 9, robs the workers of all hope of saving, investing, and bettering their condition. If you take away property, a man can't save. He can't do it. He's got no incentive. He's got a disincentive to save for himself, to make a better life for himself by saving, to work harder for himself, because whatever the fruits of his labors is all going to be taken away. So you're crippling the workers, the individual man's future. You're taking away the individual's future by preventing him from having any property. So his future is paralyzed. As for the present, again, some complications. The Pope is going to argue, 10 and 11, abolishing property violates man's natural right to own property. Because whereas animals are natured only to use things, rational man, who is not just an animal, is natured to use and possess them. The Pope says, whereas animals use nature, man uses and possesses nature. A dog uses a tree. A man uses and owns a tree in order to cut it down, to make wood, to collect apples, or whatever it is. So a man uses and possesses. Obviously, animals don't possess. They have their territory, of course, but that's not possession. It's just where the others have got to keep away and so on. So that's what he's going to argue. He's going to prove it. 12. In paragraph 12, this is a really basic argument for why the individual man, must be able to possess property. You've got a small m, big M, and a big C. That's in logic. That's a minor, a major, and a conclusion. But don't worry about that. Rational man with reason, the rational animal, which is man, is natured, is of such a nature as to provide for his own future. But the earth alone, the land beneath our feet, can continuously supply man's recurring future needs, and therefore man is of a nature to take part of the earth into possession. In other words, he has a natural right to property. God provides for the birds and the animals himself. But man has got reason, and God requires of man to use his reason to provide for himself, to provide for his own needs. God provides for the hedgehog to hibernate during the winter. By instinct, autumn comes, late autumn, and the hedgehog goes to ground, and he comes out again on February the 14th. He comes out again whenever he comes out. God has provided for his winter by making him go to sleep. Man doesn't go to sleep. Man has got to think of his winter. God has given man reason. So man is meant to use his mind to think, to store up some potatoes in order to be able to eat through the winter and start eating again in the spring. So man has got to provide for himself. Now, the only thing that can provide for the elementary and continual need of eating in particular is the land. Therefore, in God's plan, man must have land, and the individual must have some land. The individual's attachment to land is radical. And that's one reason why the Industrial Revolution, the Industrial Revolution is so grave, because it tends to cut men off from the land. The suburbs are in between. The suburbs cut people off from the land, although they do leave them with a yard. But there's not an organic, necessary relationship between the suburbanite and his yard. He pushes a mower around and just cuts the grass. He's not providing for his needs. Of course, there's somewhere for his children to play. That's partly, but there's not that close tie of necessity between man and land, which is what the Pope is talking about. Slice it which way you will, even in our society, where, milk comes out of cans. Spaghetti comes out of boxes. All food grows in plastic containers, which you buy in the supermarket. Even in this society, in fact, it still goes back to the land. And the farmers are, in our society today, a grossly abused part of the population. They are grossly abused because when you've got many people living in the city and power by vote, in other words, a quote-unquote democracy, the majority of people living in cities will always outvote the minority living on the land. Therefore, the laws of the country will always favor the people in the city and will disfavor the people on the land. Therefore, the prices of farm products are kept artificially low for the benefit of the city dwellers. The government gets votes by giving free bread and welfare checks to a number of in the big cities who do nothing. Whereas the out on the land, there's a small number of people working very hard with huge machines in order to produce with chemicals and machines a mass of food that a mass of miserable plastic food which will be consumed in the cities by the city dwellers. That's the way the government keeps a large number of voters happy at the expense of the farmers. And then the government turns around and in order to control the farmers, gives them subsidies. In other words, instead of giving them a decent price, a fair price, a supply and demand price for what they produce, it pulls the price right down and then pays subsidies to the farmers so that the farmers are in debt, are under the control of the government. The city dwellers are at the mercy of the government because the government gives them welfare checks. The farmers are at the mercy of the government because they depend upon the subsidies, because otherwise they can't make a living. What's called subsistence farm of a sensible kind. Let's say a man living with his 3, 5, 7 children on 10-20 acres of land, which is perfectly possible if it's decent land. Maybe even fewer. I don't know how many acres could a family of, say, 7-8 children live on? Today, yes. 1,000 it would take today, but that's absolutely unreasonable. Today, a man with his 5 children should, you know, a few chickens, a couple of cows, he should be able to live normally on 5 acres, 10 acres, with ordinary old-fashioned farming methods.
Yeah, subsistence farming, you don't need that much land.
That's it. Subsistence farming, you don't need much land. But subsistence farming is a thing of the past. And in Germany, I think, if you want to try to go back to the land, it's very difficult. If you want to go from the city back to the land, it's very difficult. The government will hardly allow you to buy land, unless I'm mistaken. Maybe I'm exaggerating. Where there's a will, there's a way. So that if people wanted to go back to the land, they could. But it's not easy. The government doesn't make it easy. The government does not want, today's governments do not want independent farmers who stand on their own feet and make their own decisions and are capable of thinking for themselves. They don't want that. And so the small farmer, there are fewer and fewer and more of these industrial corporations, which have farms of what I don't know, thousands of acres, with combine harvesters with a jaw reaching from one wall to the other, whereby one man driving one machine for 3 hours can pick up all the grain, wheat that's needed to feed a whole town for the whole winter. I mean, I don't know if my statistics are correct, but the general idea is these huge machines enable few people on the land to produce all that's needed for the a large number of people to eat. In brief, the country has been revolutionized along with the city by the Industrial Revolution, by modern life. But still, behind all the artificiality, behind all of the industry, behind all of the plastic, behind all of the chemicals, you've still got the fact, the obvious fact, that men depend to eat upon the land. It's as simple as that. And that men have to, by one means or another, get from the land enough to eat to last them through the winter until they can grow the next crop. That's just clear. And so, although it's that direct connection between man and land is less easy to see in modern society, nevertheless, if you stop and think, it's obvious. Man needs land in order to live. Because God has made man to provide for himself, God has not made man to automatically hibernate. Simple argument. Therefore, so rational man, back to 12. Man to whom God gave reason, God also gave a nature such as that he is to provide for his own future. God is not going to put the food in his mouth. God is not going to send an angel to put the food in his mouth. He's going to have to work for it on the land. Adam will have to dig from original sin. But the earth alone can continuously supply those constant future needs. Therefore, man, it's in the nature of man to take control of a certain part of the earth. What he needs of the earth to provide for those needs which are in his nature. And therefore, man has a natural right to property. That's the individual. Okay? That's a very basic and solid argument why man should have property. And of course, you throw any 50, 100, 1,000 men in a new country, put them in a new country. I mean, how is the United States occupied? How is the Midwest occupied by the whites? By men taking land, by the government giving land to men so that they can come out here and make a living, a decent living, with their own family on their own piece of land. It's the most elementary common sense. It's nothing grand. And it's the refutation of socialism. Socialism only arises when you are destroying this natural relationship between man and land. As long as everybody knows that a man's got to be on the land in order to live, nobody talks about separating men from their land. But when you have an industrial revolution which separates them, and then gross inequality, then you say, well, let's abolish all property. No, the answer to industrialism is not even more novelty and madness. The answer to industrialism is to go back to what there was before, which is property. And the suburbs, interestingly, I remember Archbishop Lefebvre saying that. He said, when you fly and land in the United States on an aeroplane, you come in over these cities where there are these huge suburbs, but each man has his own little bit of land. It's no longer an organic relationship with the land. Often it's no longer that he's eating his own vegetables out of his own garden, but it is still one man, one piece of land, or one family, one piece of land, and that is natural. And the Archbishop, whereas he said, contrasted with Europe, where, you know, the people in the cities are herded together so that they no longer have their own little piece of land. But it's healthy, normal, and natural for a family to have its own little piece of land. Even if it's only a suburban yard, I think you can say. So, objection 13 and objection 14. Two objections. The first objection is socialism. The state can provide for all. So men don't need to provide for themselves, the state can provide for all. Answer, the individual is prior to the state. A state is made out of a bunch of individuals. If there weren't any individuals, there wouldn't be any states. So in this respect, the individual is prior to the state. The individual is not supreme above the state, but he is prior to the state. And therefore, for the state to look after itself, you need all of the individuals to have property. If you take the individuals away from their property, you're going to destroy the state. So the individual is prior to the state, is the answer to that one. Second objection, 14. But God gave the earth to mankind in common. That's another argument of the socialists. And even they're trying to argue from God. They don't usually appeal to God. But in this case, maybe they're getting desperate. In this case, the argument is God gave the earth, all the earth to all men. Now there's a certain truth there. There's a certain truth there. But the solution is that while the earth, all the earth, it's true, is offered to everyone to serve all, nevertheless, it goes together with that. All the earth being offered to all men means that a part will be offered to each. And all men taking in possession all the earth means that this man will take in possession of this piece of the earth. Therefore, all the earth being held in common by all men means that this little piece needs to be appropriated or made proper property. This little piece needs to be made the property of this man. All of the inhabitants of such and such a town occupy all the land of this town. Yes, that's true. But nevertheless, what that means is that this family has this little bit and that family has that little bit, and they need, each needs its own little bit. And the property needs to be respected. This family needs to stay on its piece, and this family needs to stay on its piece, and they don't want to get confused and start fighting about it. And therefore, the earth being given to all men in common means that this means to go the property of this man and so on. So, lastly, so the argument for the future, you're going to take away the individual's hope of a better life if you take away from him the means of providing him for himself by his private property. Argument from the present, if you abolish property, you're denying the natural right, the natural God-given right of a man to have his own piece of land for providing for his own needs. A man, the relationship between man and land is very close. It's very natural, but we, in our society today, we lose sight of it because food comes to us in plastic, wrapped in plastic in supermarkets. And we lose sight of the whole process that's been necessary for those things in plastic to arrive in the supermarkets. And we lose sight of the farmers and farming. 15:16. The sweat of man's brow, this is now the past. The sweat of man's brow, don't worry about Antigenes' consequences, those are Latin words. The sweat of man's brow makes, marks, and enters into the land which is his property. And so to deprive man of his ownership of that property is to defraud him of the fruits of his labors. Goodness gracious, when the American pioneers arrived in the Midwest, they had to clear the land. And they had to do it by hand, by horse. Today you've got these enormous cats which can push over an oak tree. And you see in the country how they go through a piece of land and pile up all the scrub and trees and bushes and everything. It's all piled up on one side and the rest of the land is absolutely clear. With one of these huge cats and a few cans of diesel oil, you can clear a whole piece of land in a few hours with practically no effort except pulling a few levers and knowing how to drive a big cat. But in the old days, when they didn't have those things, it was by the sweat of man's brow that he cleared the land in order to make it cultivable. The vast prairies of the Midwest, I don't think there were many trees. It was a vast amount of grass, wasn't it? Open grass and prairie. But there are parts of farmland which had to be cleared of forest. There's today a lot of farmland which was originally woodland, and all of that woodland had to be cleared. It had to be cleared by hard work. And so if a man works hard to clear a field, his sweat has gone into the land, so to speak. If you then take away that land from him, you're taking away of the fruits of his labors. So you've got an argument for the future, depriving him of any hope of bettering his condition by the right use of property, taking away his natural right for the present, and depriving him of the fruits of his labors as to the past. It's a triple injustice of past, present, and future against the individual, which includes the worker. Therefore, it's an injustice against the worker to abolish property. It is, of course, paradise for the non-worker. For the welfare bum, it's paradise to abolish property. You take away everything from the rich and just shovel it out free for nothing in welfare checks to the welfare bums. They love it. So the abolition of property is a wonderful thing for the non-worker, but you're not going to be able to make a state out of non-workers. You're not going to be able to make a hive out of drones. The drones live on the workers. You can make a state out of workers, but you can't make a state out of non-workers. It's common sense. But oh no, our wonderful modern world. The welfare bums are saints, and anybody who works for a living, and he's got to be taxed until he's until the pips jump out. So, there. So much for the individual. Now for the family, and then 22 for the society. The arguments the arguments against the abolition of property, the argument for the natural right of property, based on the family. And again, it's an argument of reason. In other words, he's going to argue from the nature of the family. The nature of the family, man, wife, children. The nature of the family is such that the family needs property. And to take away the property from the family, to abolish property, is to cripple the family. Let's see how he argues it. Again, thesis, proofs, objection, and objection solved. That's a classic way for a mind to work. You lay out what you're going to prove, you prove it, and then you answer objections. That's a classic, it's simply, if you're going to think, that's the way to do it. Fix what you're going to prove it, and then answer the objections. So, what he's going to prove, 18. The individual's right to own property, which he's just proved from 9 to 17, is further reinforced by natural family obligations. Natural to the family, in the nature of the family, intrinsic to the family, are certain obligations. And these obligations also require property. Proofs as, again, present and future, 19 and 20. Then again there's an objection, and the objection is solved. The individual's right, as fatherhood is a natural right, a man has a natural right to be a father and have a family. Unless, of course, he renounces that right by a vow of chastity in the religious or whatever. Otherwise, a man has a natural right to be a father. And as fatherhood is of such a nature as to extend the person into the head of a family. When a man acquires a family, he's more than just an individual, he is the head of a family. When a man becomes a father, he's more than just an individual, he is the head of a family. And so the family is of a nature to extend the individual's right of ownership. If the single bachelor in the pioneer Midwest had the right to own property, all the more a married man with five children to feed has a right to own property against common sense. If the single man, simply by being a man, for reasons of past, present and future, for the sweat of his brow, for his need to provide for himself and for his hope for a better future, if the individual, even without a family, has a natural right to property, all the more when that individual becomes the head of a family with a responsibility to feed his children and his wife, all the more he has a right to property. Pure common sense. 20. Future. Also, 20, as to the future, the natural obligation and desire to provide for one's children's future requires property to bequeath to them. Somebody gave me yesterday an interesting argument for monarchy against democracy. I'm not pleased. The church is even, but this was an interesting argument. One of you gave it to me. And the argument was that whereas a king whose son is going to possess the kingdom will look after the kingdom in order to bequeath it to his son, and will make sure that the kingdom is not damaged or pillaged. On the contrary, a democratic official who knows he's only in power for eight years is going to get out of it all that he can while he can. Because a democratic politician is not going to bequeath anything to his son. He doesn't have to look after his children, so he's just going to soak the system, as best he can. It's an interesting argument. I'm not saying that it's the beginning and the end of the question. But the argument highlights this fact of human nature. It's an absolute elementary given of human nature that a man wants to look after his son's future. A man wants to provide for his sons, and he wants to give his sons a good start in life. It's the most natural thing of all. And so property will enable a man to look after his sons. A man is able to bequeath to his sons. What then, of course, do the socialists do? Death duties. Karl Marx. If Karl Marx didn't think up death duties, taxing the estate when somebody dies, so that half of it goes to the state and only half goes to the heirs. If Karl Marx didn't think of death duties, he was strongly for death duties. Bless the United States of America. Just recently, weren't they in Washington considering doing away with the death tax?
Yes.
And did they, have they done away with it?
No,
they haven't. The socialists have won. But even the, I don't think in England they'd even still be, in England I don't think they'd even still be thinking of doing away with the death tax. In America, there's somebody is still thinking of it. There's a still, there's an instinct in America against socialism. God bless America in that respect. That there's a resistance to these rotten socialist principles, and there is of course in the United States a sense of property. It's not this part of the encyclical that Americans are going to disagree with. It's when we turn over the page that we're going to get hit rough water. But the Catholic Church is a balance. Once again, I say before we get there, I've been throwing up some defensive works before we get there. The Catholic Church is a balance. And a balance which you can unbalance in either of two opposite directions. And you and I need to think like Catholics. Okay, as to present and future, the family extends the individual's right, reinforces the individual's right to own property. Objection, the end of 20, I think that is. But they will say, the socialists will say, the state can and should provide for the future. And that, of course, is what happens in England. I mean, what happens is the state gets everybody under its control. The state, by estate taxes, I forget what it's called in English, it's not called the death tax, the estate tax, inheritance, I forget what it's called, death duties, there we are, death duties, I think it's called, which are crippling. I should know something about it. The death duties are terrible. And the more you own, and the death duties are one way of destroying the aristocracy. The death duties are a powerful way of leveling everybody down. Because, and the death duties in France, especially, and I'm sure the same is in England, if a duke owns a handsome castle, let's say, with a magnificent estate, and he dies, his children have got to pay so much that they have to sell the property. Guess who buys it? In England, the dukes, in order to defend their property, they have to start a circus, or they have to build a lion's park or something like that. Get the people come in and pay to visit a lion's park. Or they have to turn the house into a museum and have people walking around looking at them drinking tea. You know, I mean, some of the aristocrats in England, who've inherited big estates, some of them are very imaginative and they do manage to preserve their estate. But it takes an effort to save your estate from death tax, from death duties. So, death duties are a powerful way of leveling down. They're a powerful instrument of socialism. And they are obviously against private property. So, the state can and should provide, because the state will pillage the rich, and then it will shell out welfare checks to the poor, and so the state is providing. And in Russia, if some of the poor Russians now look back with longing at communism, it's because communism did provide. It provided in a miserable way, but you were sure of at least a leaking roof over your head, and you were sure of some miserable food. You did have something provided for you. It was miserable. And communism did untold damage to the spiritual life of the people. It takes away their initiative in Germany, where East Germany is now reunited with West Germany. The West Germans call the East Germans Ostis. The German for East is Ost. The Ostis have lost all habit of work. When East Germany opened up to the West, West Germany started putting lots of money into East Germany to try to pump it up again. And East Germany was one of the best, quote unquote, best of the communist countries. But the Germans, who are a hard-working and able people, communism had completely demoralized them. As workers, they were completely demoralized. As the West Germans found. Now, after 13 years after the Berlin Wall fell, The East Germans are beginning to get things together again. But the West Germans have tried to invest in East Germany, and it hasn't worked. It hasn't paid off. The East Germans have been really demoralized. And they were the best. The best have been demoralized by communism. So on the one hand, when it says the state will provide, a communist state will provide, but in such a way, it won't provide very much, firstly, and it will provide in such a way as in a way so as to demoralize the people. The people are completely demoralized. Like in the United States, those people who get welfare checks, welfare checks, welfare checks are demoralized. They have no morals. Their families are completely shot. The government deliberately maintains them as welfare bums because they're sure of their vote. The welfare bums come to be entirely dependent on the welfare checks, and therefore the government has them at its mercy. And no politician in our miserable system dare breathe against social security or against welfare. You can't breathe. And yet they're very unhealthy. They're unnatural and abnormal because they work against private property and they deprive the worker of his incentive and they destroy his family. Wretched. Wretched. I'm sure all of you agree with this page, okay? Right. They will say, the state can and should provide. And I say, well, look at how the communist Russia provided. The only reason why the poor Russians, hanker after communism is precisely that they went from the communist frying pan into a free-for-all fire. They went from the frying pan into the fire. The communist system, the communist life was not good in Russia. But for many of them, the capitalist, the quote-unquote capitalism that's come in since is even worse. And guess who that capitalism is organized and run by? The same usurers and money men and sharks. And if there's nobody in Russia who can control the money men and the sharks, the last state of Russia is going to be worse than the first. And they're going to look back on the good old days of communism. So, communism is not the answer, socialism is not the answer, and free-for-all capitalism, to give free rein to the usurers and the capitalists is not the answer. They're going to soak and destroy a nation for their own benefit. That's what many of the Western capitalists did when they went into Russia and introduced quote-unquote democracy and quote-unquote capitalism there. Now, the Russians are a proud nation, and they are presently very offended in their pride and in their nationalism by being invaded by McDonald's and the rest of it. I mean, McDonald's is, compared with what the Russians have a real culture. They've got great music, great literature, great ballet. You know, they stand for something. And then to see that all of this, these supposed wiser and better people from the West just flooding in with McDonald's and things like that. So there's a pride in Russia which is reacting or going to react, and Putin is heading up some of that. Who knows what's going on in Russia today? Who knows? The Russian bear. He's certainly not converted, and so the religious problem is not solved, and therefore there's every likelihood that the political problem is not solved either. In fact, there's the practical certainty that there is the certainty that the religious and that the political and economic problems are not solved either. So, 21. Answer. The state may help out the family in destitution and disputes, but children enter a state or society only through a family, and so the prior existing family has prior rights and duties. Same argument as with the individual. Just as in the case of the individual, he said, the individual is prior to the state. The state can look after the individual is prior to the state. That was 13. The state can look after the family. Answer, the family is prior to the state. I'll give you an example of that. It's clear today. The family, as the family disintegrates, the dear good state, let's give the state credit, tries to intervene. For instance, to stop man and woman, husband and wife destroying one another. There's a dispute in the family, either between husband and wife, or the husband and wife are violating the children, or the husband's violating the children, the wife is turning a blind eye. The troubles inside the family. The state does its best. Honest people in today's states, in Minnesota or wherever it is, they try to do their best. The police come in to try to stop husband and wife killing one another. But the problem isn't a problem that the state can handle. The state takes the children away that are being violated and tries to find a foster home and tries to protect the children. But that's assuming that there's still some adults who can run a foster home. The state needs decent adults to be able to entrust the children to from the rotten adults. But supposing there are no more decent adults, it's not a problem the state can handle. It's not a problem the state's meant to handle. Because the family is prior to the state. And the understanding between husband and wife and the natural and normal looking after of children by parents is something that is for the, should be for the state a given. It's not something that the state knows about. It's not something the state can do. It's not something that the state can replace. It doesn't come in with the state's competence. Only if there's a mess must the state intervene. Then it must intervene. For instance, a husband and wife are about to kill their mother. The police officer's got to go in. A police officer arrest just got killed apparently recently in Twin Cities for doing that. Domestic violence is basically is a problem that only religion can solve, because only religion can get to the individual is prior to the family, and the family is prior to the state. The state can't solve the problems of the family. It can't solve the problems of the individual. Because the individual and the family are prior to the state. The state presupposes solid families, which presupposes sane individuals. How can you make a family, a healthy family, with a crazy dad? A dad, for instance, crazy with pornography. How can you make a healthy family when the dad is crazy with pornography? The healthy family presupposes a sane individual, and a healthy state presupposes healthy families. The state can't produce healthy families, it supposes healthy families. Because the family is prior to the state. And so the state can look after the family in exceptional cases, in necessity and in emergency, yes. But as a normal rule, no. That's not his business. Dad must look after the family. And mum must look after the family. And dad must look after mum, and mum look after dad, and so on. I mean, so, the state may help out the family in destitution and disputes. But it mustn't, as a general rule, have to look after the family. Or try to get into the family. But children enter a state only, or society only through a family. And so the prior existing family has prior rights and duties. As the individual is prior to the family in this respect, so the family is prior to the state. And as the family is not designed to solve the individual's problems, but only the confessional gets to the individual. The confessional, the pulpit and the confessional get to the heart of the matter. That's here, right here. The real problem of good and evil is right here, in my heart and my mind. It's not my family, it's not my state, that's where it is. The religion can get to the individual, and through the individual gets to the family, and through the individual and the family gets to the state. But the state can't do it. The state is at the end of the line. The state is very important, but in this respect, it's at the end of the line. So, in brief, 22, the conclusion is that socialism will ravage society with turmoil, envy, enslavement, poverty, and universal wretchedness. And I saw that when I was briefly, several years ago, a very brief visit in Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. And those countries have been devastated by communism. They're a wasteland. Especially Hungary. Poland, of course, has kept some of the faith. But the Czech Republic and Hungary, wasteland, spiritually a wasteland because of communism. Those years and years of communism. Maybe things are picking up a little now, but what are they picking up with? Western materialism. It's hardly better. 11 o'clock, we turn over the page. Da, da, dum, bum.